Security Project. Thanks for coming. I hear the mic coming up, so I'll stop shouting now. The American Security Project is a nonpartisan think tank, very rare thing in this town. We try and talk about national security issues and make policy recommendations based on what we think is the right thing for U.S. national security and global interests. We like to keep it right down the middle. It's, like I say, a tough job, but we can do it, and I hope you'll read everything on our website. Today we have one of the most important North Korean scholars in the United States, Joel Witt. I met Joel while at the State Department many, many years ago. He has surpassed anyone in his North Korean work. We worked together with Bob Gallucci on the agreed framework, and it's been a long time since we have frozen North Korean nuclear capabilities. But there's so much more work to be done, and I hope, Joel, you'll be able to fill us all in on your latest findings.
Is this thing absolutely essential?
Yes.
Yes.
Otherwise, we can't pick up the sound.
Even though I'm very loud.
It's good.
Okay. I'll have to tone it down a little. Anyway, thank you, Terry. It's nice to be here and to remember the good old days when we were negotiating arms control agreements with the Soviet Union. Today, what I'd like to do is two things. The first is I'm going to show you some new pictures of WMD facilities in North Korea, and some of it is actually very interesting, what's going on. And these pictures are over the spring. The most recent ones are from June 1st. And as a matter of fact, even as we speak, we're probably breaking some news with the Associated Press and on our website, 38 North. So I want to go through the pictures, and then I'll give you a little bit of my take of where we are in dealing with North Korea and, you know, what the future may hold as well. So let's start with the pictures here. I hope everyone can see them. When I used to look at these pictures in the U.S. government, it was kind of humorous because a lot of us couldn't tell what we were looking at, but we would shake our heads knowingly whenever an analyst started to talk about what they're looking at. So you can just shake your heads knowingly if you don't see what I'm talking about. This is the North Korean nuclear test facility, and it's an overview of the whole facility. So you can see the different tunnel complexes. There's one, it says North Building Complex, that's also called the West Portal. Don't ask me why. And there's another one down there, the South Tunnel Complex. So that's basically the whole facility. Access road leads into the facility, and that leads to the town of Punggye-ri. So this is an overview of the whole facility taken in January before their last test. I'm going to skip to the news for a second. What you're looking at here is the area where we suspect the last nuclear test was taken, and this is after the test was taken. And you see there's nothing going on. Well, if you progress forward in April, we're seeing some preliminary work there, and you can see several pieces of equipment laid out in front of the tunnel entrances and buildings. And you can't see, there's a cloud down here in the right-hand corner, and what you can't see is that it's pretty clear when you get to May that they're digging. There's new activity going on in terms of digging in this area. Now, what it is, of course, we can't be sure, and there are a couple of possibilities. One is they're beginning construction of another tunnel in this area. We suspect there are already two tunnels in this area. Secondly, they're either completing or repairing a tunnel in the West Portal area. So there may be another tunnel there that is incomplete and they may be finishing it. Or they may be clearing debris from existing tunnels. I won't go into great detail, but we do have some pieces in the works that basically say that we think both of the last two nuclear tests were conducted in this area. The last test is still somewhat unclear and people haven't quite nailed it down, but we think there's a lot of evidence suggesting this area was where the last test was. When I say that they're digging and it's pretty serious, you can tell by the color of the spoil area. And here's the most recent image in June 1st. You can tell by the color, the gray color, that this is coming out of the mountain. It's not just dirt that they're moving over there. And that's because of the gray color of the area. So there's digging going on. Let me emphasize, I'm not saying that there's going to be a nuclear test tomorrow. It doesn't look like this is part of preparations for the near term. It looks like it's more of a long-term effort. And that's a conclusion we reach in part because a lot of the cart rails here are installed cart rails, which means this is a long-term digging project that they have, and it may be necessary for the conduct of future nuclear tests here. So it's very interesting. This is all happening in spring, started in April, May, June. Despite everything that's been going on in terms of sanctions, in terms of the Chinese supposedly stepping up pressure on North Korea, I'm skeptical about that. And in spite of what appears to be a North Korean peace offensive at the moment. So it's very important to remember this because while all this is happening, the North Koreans are quietly working away at efforts to move forward their nuclear program. Let me go backwards. I skipped some stuff. I want to go backwards because we've been doing some historical research, which I think could be very interesting. You know, one of the problems we have when we look at the North Korean nuclear test site, and even when we can see a lot of activity and we know that something may be coming up, it's very hard to predict that there will be a nuclear test. It's extremely difficult. The way we used to do this with the Soviet Union, and they conducted, of course, hundreds of tests, and I actually used to work on that when I worked with Terry, was, you know, organizations go about their business in very predictable ways. So we could basically watch the Soviet nuclear test site, see what was happening, and we sort of had a timetable for when they would do certain things leading up to a nuclear test. So, you know, 20 days before the test, you would see certain activities. 10 days before the test, you would see other activities. And it was predictable. Every time, they would basically do it the same way. With North Korea, you don't have that database, of course, because they've only conducted 3 nuclear tests. So what we've been trying to do is figure out, well, is there any indicators here before they test? And what we found is one possible indicator. So you will see that we pointed at a possible SATCOM dish in the area of the tunnel entrances in the west portal area. The SATCOM dish is there to transmit data before a test happens. That's what we think. It's a high-speed way of transmitting data to places other than at the nuclear test site. So we see it here before the 2009 test. Basically a few days, a week or so. I can't remember the exact day, but it was there a week or so before, 2 weeks before. Okay, fast forward 2013, before the February test, well, what do we see? We see another, this airs the SATCOM dish again, before the test. It disappears when the test happens. It's not there after. You know, so this may be something, we can't be certain, but it's certainly an interesting thing that we've spotted, and I guess we'd have to wait for the next nuclear test to continue to try to prove this hypothesis. But, you know, I think when a SATCOM dish does appear again in the future, you know, we can treat that as a possible indicator that a nuclear test is imminent. In addition to that kind of historical work, we've also been kind of looking at the test site around the time of the nuclear test itself. And so this is right before the nuclear test took place. And what you see in the area, the main support area near the portals, you see a lot of personnel and vehicles present, which of course makes perfect sense. If you're preparing for a nuclear test, there's going to be a lot of activity there. What's interesting is we see this kind of unique vehicle with camouflage netting covering it. And we're not quite sure what it's for, but it may actually be related to the nuclear device itself. Once again, we're just speculating. We've looked at different possibilities, and this seems to us at least possible. So it's just another interesting piece of the historical analysis we're working on to get a sort of a complete picture of what happens when North Korea conducts a nuclear test. Just keep going forward here. Oh, one other activity at the test site, which is kind of interesting, is we've noticed, you can see in the February picture, they're kind of cutting down trees in that area there. It's a totally new area. It may be part of what is the beginning of excavating new tunnels. It may be other things too. It could be they're building more buildings there, support facilities. We can't tell, except that it's very hard to get to this area. So that might argue against more support facilities. And what's happening is the area is expanding. And it's been expanding over the past few months. So we're going to keep a close eye on that. Who knows what it means? But if we start seeing them digging new tunnels, that's obviously an interesting development. This is not anything really new. We've been running pieces on our website looking at the 5-megawatt reactor.
What's your website?
Oh, 38 North. Thank you.
Thank you.
We've been running pieces on our website looking at what's going on at these facilities. North Korea is building a light water reactor. They call it experimental light water reactor. It's gone up very rapidly. And they're also restarting their 5-megawatt plutonium production reactor. They announced that, I guess it was the beginning of April, and we're watching them moving forward with the construction of what they need to do to restart. And you notice it specifies location of former cooling tower, and that's for the 5-megawatt reactor. That was blown up, I guess it was in 2007 or 2008, I can't remember. You may have seen the pictures on the news. It was as a result of an agreement reached by the Bush administration to shut down the 5-megawatt reactor. They had this big press event where they blew up the cooling tower. Well, now the North Koreans are moving forward on restarting the reactor. This just shows you activity around the light water reactor, what's going on there. The building is essentially externally complete. We think all the equipment is inside. They're basically loading it up with the wiring and whatever else they need to do to finish the internal part of it. Construction at the 5-megawatt reactor to restart that. Basically what they're doing is they're not rebuilding the cooling tower. That would take them probably longer than what they're doing. They're constructing a cooling system hooking up the 5-megawatt reactor to the pump house they've already built for the light water reactor. And it's very interesting because it's very clear that, like any good organization, the North Korean nuclear scientists had a contingency plan for restarting the 5-megawatt reactor. And I think that's what's going in place now. It's clear that they've had this plan in place, and it's a plan to at least put back in place a cooling system much quicker than just, you know, rebuilding the cooling tower. And indeed, they used a similar system, or were planning to use a similar system for the reactor they were building in Syria. So it's very much the same kind of cooling system, only something they can do quicker. This is just a little bit of the, you know, photo interpreter, the kinds of things photo interpreters look at. There's a transshipment yard right near where these facilities are. And we haven't been looking at it regularly, but in looking back at what's been going on there, it's clear that there's been stuff piled up there and then it's moved out of there. And of course, we're not sure where it's moved out to, but I think a good conclusion is it's piled up there and then it's moved out there to finish work at the 5-megawatt reactor and the light water reactor. So it's very interesting that we're going to go back and do some historical research on that just to see if we can spot different kinds of equipment in the yard that may have been moved into the reactor. Okay, so what's happening on the missile front? This is just an interesting picture from not this year, a year ago. It's of the KN-08 ICBM, Road Mobile ICBM. You can see them, the larger missiles in back there. The ones in front are the Musudan missiles, which people thought the North Koreans were going to fire one off a few months ago, and they never did. But you know, you get a good look at both types of missiles in this parade. What I want to do is skip to this, because this is also a very interesting development. This is the older test site. It's called Musudan Ri, or other people call it Tonghae. And this is where they used to test, you know, the older missiles, the Scuds, and, you know, the clunkier missiles they had. But what's been going on at the older site is while they've been testing missiles from the new launch site, which they just finished a year or two ago, or 3 years ago, they've been building new facilities at the old launch site. The new facilities are for much larger missiles, maybe 3 to 4 times the size of the Unha missile, which, you know, is the one they've been launching. That's pretty big. So we're thinking it's about the size of, I forgot the name of it, but a Chinese space launch vehicle. Well, what's been happening is, after a lot of construction last year, nothing. There's been no construction this year at all at the key facilities at this site. You could, of course, say, well, wintertime, they're not going to be building anything. That makes perfect sense. But we're now into May, end of May pictures. Nothing going on. You see the launch pad here, the control building, fuel storage sites, nothing. Then you see the control building, the assembly building, no change. So, I don't know what this means, to be honest with you. It's new, it's interesting, it's too soon to say what it might mean. There are a number of possibilities. One is, you know, maybe they're trying to send a signal to someone. One is, maybe they're, you know, changed their plans for the future of their rocket force. Another one is maybe they don't have enough money now to build the two sites. I mean, you can go on and on and on, and I think what we're going to do is keep watching this in the next month or two and see if this continues. And if it does continue and nothing happens, it's very interesting. It's an interesting development. So that's the end of the slideshow. Interesting stuff going on at both of these facilities, and we keep watching them at 38 North. And I think there is the satellite photography is obviously an important source of information on what's going on in terms of North Korea's WMD programs. And so we're going to continue watching all of these facilities and try to find some more as well. That's the first half of what I'm supposed to talk about. The second half I'm supposed to talk about is, you know, what are we supposed to do about this? Which, of course, I've been doing on and on for 20 years, but and every time I give a presentation, I try to do something different. I'm not sure I always succeed, but, you know, there's been a lot of stuff going on now in the past few months, and so what I want to do is try to evaluate where we are and where we might be heading. And I'm not going to talk about the basics here. I don't have to explain to all of you why North Korea's growing WMD capability is important and represents a serious problem, not just for us, but Northeast Asia, the international community. Obviously, figuring out a policy is difficult, but part of the problem here, and I'm going to be very honest with you, is that there are very few experts on North Korea in Washington or in the United States. That's part one of the problem. The second problem is there are a lot of myths about North Korea that are out there, and you know, whenever you read the media, you'll see them. Hermit Kingdom, failing state. Another one the administration likes, or another couple that the administration likes to throw around is, you know, we're not going to talk for talk's sake, which implies that we've done a lot of that in the past, and we're not going to buy the same horse twice, which of course implies we've done a lot of that. I think all of that is just wrong, and anyone who knows the history of this issue would tell you that's not. I did an interview in January for a South Korean wire service, and I said the only way the U.S. was going to change its current policy, which is called strategic patience, and basically that means isolating North Korea and waiting for it to make concessions, a policy which I believe is not working, and I think that was pretty clear at the end of last year. The only way we were going to change if the new South Korean president came to town, President Park, pushed hard for a change. And she didn't do that. And indeed, now I think we're moving into an even worse phase in our policy. And I've kind of dubbed it Strategic Patience 2.0. And I think we continue to pursue the approach that we are going to put pressure on them and wait for concessions. And not only that, but I would argue that our approach now, we're skating dangerously close to accepting North Korea as a nuclear state. We say constantly we're not going to do that, but to me that is sounding increasingly hollow. Let me explain. Strategic Patience 2.0 is basically the administration's own old policy, but it's on steroids. We're stepping up efforts to deter North Korea's military provocations. We're putting in place new sanctions. I have no problem with that. Let me say that. No problem at all. We should be doing those kinds of things, given the activities they pursued in the past 5 or 6 months. But what we're also doing is we're doubling down on our disinterest in diplomacy. I mean, we're not even interested in talking about having talks with them at this point. And that doubling down process is reflected in preconditions for talks, and we have absolutely no interest in exploring any of the recent North Korean initiatives in which they say, let's talk. So what's happened? How have we gotten to this point? To me, the biggest factor here, it's very interesting. The biggest factor here is what the administration says, at least publicly, is China's shift in its approach to North Korea. The administration is trying to portray China's policy now as a significant sea change in their approach. And the storyline is that Beijing is now going to put real pressure on North Korea to come to talks and denuclearize. So from the administration's position or viewpoint, this is an important development. It's a sign that strategic patience works, and it's now enlisted Beijing in that effort, and hence we have Strategic Patience 2.0. Now, from my perspective, I think this is an incredibly over-optimistic reading of China's position. There's been some movement by the Chinese, but not because of anything we've done. It's because the Chinese are miffed by the North Koreans and what they've been doing. And moreover, I don't think the movement has been as much as people at least have been portraying publicly. There's still a handful of Chinese foreign policy experts who say denuclearization is the priority, but they've been saying this for a while now. It's not something new. And there are many others who say China's interests and policy has not changed, and that denuclearization is one of a number of priorities, but it's by no means the main priority. And I haven't seen any official statements from the Chinese that say denuclearization is now king. And finally, it's clear, while you hear a lot about Chinese pressure on North Korea, what you don't hear a lot about is that the Chinese are stepping up assistance to North Korea at the same time. One of the signs of that is we had another satellite photo analysis piece on 38 North a few weeks ago, looking at one of the proposed free trade zones between China and North Korea. Essentially, there had been nothing going on there for maybe over a year. And then, all of a sudden, last fall, construction, continuing up into the spring, and it's continuing now. Well, that says to me that the Chinese decided to move forward with more economic cooperation with the North Koreans, even as all this other stuff was happening. It's a smart move, don't get me wrong. I think it's smarter than to sort of put pressure on, but also to build up their leverage over the North Koreans. But we're kind of portraying what's going on as something that in fact is not going on. And there are significant disagreements between us and the Chinese over how to deal with North Korea. And the most serious is over the role of diplomacy. I keep coming back to diplomacy. You can see there's a theme here. The Chinese want more diplomacy to find a way out of the current standoff. They'll tell you sanctions and deterrence alone won't work. They believe denuclearization has to be part of a broader approach, broader diplomatic effort, designed to build peace and security in the region, including reaching a peace treaty. Well, that's what the North Koreans have been talking about for a while now. They want to sign a peace treaty with the United States and others. I don't think we're getting the message, or maybe we are, but we're pretending we're not. And we're only interested in this policy of strategic patience 2.0. So one of the problems here is without the US diplomatic effort kicking in, the Chinese may eventually get fed up with us, and we're gonna lose the battle for their hearts and minds with the North Koreans, who are not stupid. They understand what's going on, and part of their peace offensive is to play to the Chinese peanut gallery. And on top of that, by not exploring what the North Koreans are saying in terms of their possible interest in discussions, we will lose the chance, if there is a chance, of finding a peaceful way out of this situation through diplomacy with the North Koreans. So I would say that rather than getting close to a breakthrough on denuclearization, and I think the administration is trying to portray that now we have everyone on the side of what it's trying to do, and I don't think that's the case. Rather than close to a breakthrough, I would say we're much closer to tacit acceptance of North Korea as a nuclear power. We've had 4 years of no talks, of course. There's a new batch of leaders in the region. And what we're seeing is all of the countries in the region are looking for room to pursue their diverse goals vis-a-vis North Korea. Now, of course, everyone pays lip service to denuclearization, but that's not the be-all and end-all for all these other countries. Maybe it is for us, but it's not for the others, including our allies. So what you have is President Park's administration has explicitly changed the approach from its predecessor of making denuclearization a precondition for engaging Pyongyang, and it's going to pursue its own, what it calls it, a trust-building process, which means moving forward to a certain degree without even talking about denuclearization. You have the Japanese Prime Minister sending a senior-level envoy recently to North Korea, and he even said he would go to North Korea himself if there was a way to resolve the abductee issue. Very important for Japan, I think we can all understand that, but that's going to be happening without denuclearization. It's going to be happening without, it could happen without any discussion over nuclear issues. And what you're also seeing on the Chinese-North Korean front is they are beginning to reopen high-level channels with the recent visits of senior North Korean officials to Beijing. So in short, everyone wants denuclearization. Everyone says, yes, denuclearization, that's very important. But I think the only country who puts it at the top of the list of priorities is the United States. And we're the only ones who can convince Pyongyang to go through with it. And indeed, it's very funny, the Chinese will tell you that it's the US is the only one who has leverage over North Korea, not them. So to me, all of this is leading to a reality, whether we want to acknowledge it or not, that we are acquiescing in North Korea as a nuclear power. And that indeed part of North Korea's diplomatic strategy is working. It's carving out a space where it's tacitly accepted as a nuclear weapons state. Well, what should we do about this? Everyone says, yes, coercive diplomacy, very important in dealing with states like North Korea, dealing with states like Iran. But coercive diplomacy should consist of coercion and diplomacy, not just coercion. So we need to kick in with the second part of that policy. And what I talk about, for lack of a better advertising phrase, is a policy of strong diplomacy made strong in part by the tough measures that we enact. You know, it's very interesting. I was reading an article Sunday in the New York Times, I don't know how many of you saw it, about Secretary Kerry and his sort of philosophy of diplomacy. And it said one of his key precepts for diplomacy is the best and only way to achieve a breakthrough is to tackle core issues as quickly as possible while avoiding getting bogged down in tangential debates over preconditions. Well, of course, this was applying mainly to the Middle East, but That's exactly what a number of us have been talking about in terms of strong diplomacy with North Korea. That's not what we're doing with North Korea. So building on that kind of overall framework, let me lay out some guidelines for what we should be doing in terms of our diplomacy with North Korea. And then I'm gonna talk about a few specific next steps, and then I'll stop quickly. The first is, well, focus on core issues. Secretary says you need to tackle core issues. We need to focus on core issues. That doesn't mean offering North Korea 100,000 tons of food for it to give up its nuclear weapons. Since last summer, at least, the North Koreans have been saying we need to tackle core security issues. For them, it's peace treaty. For us, it's the nuclear weapons and the WMD issues. Second, we need to understand the central importance of political relations. Shifting political relations, and I'm not saying we're going to become friends with North Korea overnight, but shifting political relations opens the door to dealing with a variety of agendas that we need to deal with. It's not just WMD. It's everything from WMD to human rights. Politics is key. Third, we need to lower our expectations. No one should expect that North Korea is going to immediately solve these core issues, they're going to immediately give up denuclearization, or that we're going to immediately have a peace treaty. It's going to be stage by stage, like a lot of other diplomatic efforts. Fourth, we need to have the patience to sustain a dialogue with North Korea. Even if we get traction, it's going to be long and difficult. So we need to be able to stick with it over time. And finally, we have to be willing to deploy diplomatic assets as necessary. We need to lead from the front of the pack on this issue, not from way behind, which is what we're doing now. We also need to be willing to deploy the full range of U.S. government officials as appropriate. And finally, we need to be flexible on the process. Let's all stop our fixation with the six-party talks, particularly if process detracts from substance, from making progress. There are lots of processes here. If we can make progress on substance, that's the first order issue. So what about next steps? What are initial moves for the United States? Well, first, we need to start sending messages to North Korea that our door is open to talk about talks. Not to negotiate, not to make concessions, not to appease North Korea. Just to talk about having talks. The offer needs to be made without preconditions. It's easy to communicate it. We can do it directly through some diplomatic channels or indirectly. We can even use chance encounters at track 2 meetings or track 1.5 meetings. There are a whole bunch of ways we can do that. Secondly, if we think that we're getting some traction, then we can move into a new phase. And this is what a friend of mine calls the reconnaissance and force phase of diplomacy. Once again, we're not negotiating. We're not appeasing, we're not making concessions, we're trying to gather more information. And we use this discussion to explore how to find a way into talks, and also use it to find a way forward if we do get to talks. The other thing that this can help us with is, most people, of course, have never sat in meetings with North Koreans, including many people in the U.S. government. But you learn a lot from these meetings. You can learn a lot about what's going on in Pyongyang. Certainly that's something I think it would be useful to know, since we don't really seem to know much about that. How do you do the reconnaissance in force? Be flexible. You know, I have another friend who says you can go low and slow, not high and fast. So you can start at lower levels and move into other levels depending upon how much progress you make. So these are just a few, I think it's just common sense, a few common sense things that we can do. Unfortunately, we aren't doing it, and I sense no desire in the Obama administration to take any of these steps. So let me stop here. I've gone a teeny bit over.
We'll take your questions now. Please identify yourself. And right there, please.
Hi, Rachel Oswald, Global Security Newswire.
Here he comes. One more time.
Rachel Oswald, Global Security Newswire. Mr. Litt, could you go back to the slides about of the cooling system being installed with the old plutonium reactor? Would the use of that cooling system for the old plutonium reactor mean that the experimental light water reactor might not go online as soon as was formally thought, or would they be able to both share it?
They're sharing. They're going to share. It looks like they'll share the same pump house. So at least the calculation, our calculation is it won't affect the operational when the light water reactor will be operational. There's another point here which I didn't mention. I want to get it in now about when these things can start working. The big question mark here is not, you know, I don't think they're faking it. Some people say, oh, gee, this could just be deception. You know, if they are faking it, wow. You know, you see equipment moving in and out of the transshipment yard for the past year and a half. You see the building going up. You know, it's not faking it on that count. It's not faking it on the 5-megawatt reactor. The big uncertainty here about when these things will actually start working is the availability of fuel. On the 5-megawatt reactor, we know they have a lot of fuel rods that were made for a bigger reactor, a 50-megawatt reactor, which, surprise, sort of went into disrepair under the agreed framework and has never been restarted. So they had a lot of fuel rods. They needed to do some retooling. And when they're available, I think will determine when this thing actually starts up. If you think that they had a contingency plan in place, then you have to believe they had a plan for retooling the fuel rods, and they didn't just say, oh gee, you know, my God, we announced yesterday we're restarting this reactor. Now we gotta hurry up and retool the rods. So, but I don't know. I mean, we have no other evidence one way or the other. On the light water reactor, it's a whole different kettle of worms. They need to produce fuel rods for that reactor. The rods need to use low enriched uranium. We don't know whether they're producing LEU or not. And on top of that, putting together the fuel assemblies for the rods is evidently a very technically challenging task. So we don't know where they are in that part of the equation of the light water reactor. Normally when you're building a light water reactor, there's a long sort of trial period. You don't just kind of start it up and operate it. There's a long period of maybe 9 to 12 months when you're trying. You're kind of, it's a shakedown cruise for the reactor. And we don't know when they're going to start that, but it looks at least like the construction is done externally, and I would wager a bet that they're pretty done to being finished with the construction internally. Sorry, that may be a longer answer.
That was a great
question. Anyone else? Yes, over there.
Kevin Meyer for WorldDocs. Do you think North Korea would be willing to give up its nuclear program if we agreed to withdraw our troops from South Korea?
I don't know. Honestly, the short answer is I don't know. to my mind, I mean, I don't know if they'll ever give up their nuclear weapons, honestly, but to my mind, the way to move down that path is to combine our core security concerns with their core security concerns. So that means a phase-by-phase process where we move towards denuclearization over time, and we move towards a peace treaty over time. Would a peace treaty mean the end of the USROK alliance and US troops leave South Korea? I think if it meant that, we wouldn't do it, honestly. In the past, the North Koreans have been flexible on the presence of US troops in South Korea under different political circumstances. That's why I said politics are key. If the political relationships here are much better, then the North Koreans may not care as much about US troops in the South. They may not feel that they need a lot of nuclear weapons if the political relationships are good. So, you know, I just don't know the answer to that. It's unpredictable, but it's important to remember that it hasn't always been a hard and fast condition of the North Koreans that U.S. troops have to leave the peninsula.
Way in the back there.
Agla from the Center for Novel Operation Studies. So I have a question for you regarding subcritical centrifuges. Is there any...
You know, let me preface my remarks by saying I'm channeling technical experts up here. So go ahead.
Just in principle, we're not seeing in the UN panel of experts support, the newest one included, any serious importation of materials. And
Serious importation? You mean...
Like the materials that we're tracking that we know would be necessary for the centrifuges that they currently have. So seeing how there's discourse that there's reason to believe that there's potentially a second facility and we're not seeing the movement of these materials. And with Alex Montgomery's article in mind that the whole AQ-Khan centrifuge model might have actually complicated matters rather than simplified it. Would you have reason to believe that the North Koreans could have perhaps gone with a more simple subcritical design, which would be more conducive to using simpler materials, which they have more access for? I mean, I understand this is purely speculation, but I just wanted to pick your brains regarding that. And thank you for the talk. I really enjoyed it.
You know, I haven't read the report. I know it just came out yesterday. So, but let's conduct a little exercise. Why do you think the UN panel knows what's going on in terms of the black market in these materials? I would say that I bet you there's a lot more they don't know than they do know. That's the first thing. Secondly, as I said, I haven't read the report, but my understanding is that most of the actions by the international community with regard to stopping imports into North Korea or whatever other activities are going on have been missile related. I don't know if there's a record of a nuclear one, at least recently. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that my bottom line is we're pretty clueless about what's going on in terms of the black market and North Korea's nuclear program. Secondly, let's assume there are two possibilities. One is that indeed North Korea has had problems importing the right materials, continues to need to import the materials, and so that activity is ongoing. There's an emerging school of thought, I don't know who's right, that in fact a lot of it they can build by themselves. And there was an article in Arms Control Wonk yesterday that by Scott Kemp, who you may know, who is a really well-known expert on uranium enrichment technology. And I think we're going to see more of these articles. And the thrust of these articles is we've underestimated North Korea's industrial capability to build pieces of a centrifuge. So maybe they don't need to import a lot of stuff. So that is possible. We don't know for sure. All we know is what we saw in 2010 when Sig Hecker went to Yongbyon. People have extrapolated from that. We've had some of those pieces on our site by Ali Hainonen, who used to work at the IAEA, David Albright, who many people know is a well-known non-proliferation expert, where they do scenarios forward. There are some people who think North Korea is already producing HEU. People in the US government, some of them believe North Korea is already producing HEU. Others think, no, they probably aren't yet producing HEU. So to me, it's a big black hole. And I get what you're saying, and I often feel that we underestimate what the North Koreans can do. As a general proposition, I think we kind of poo-poo their ability to do these kinds of things. And I've found that we've been wrong more times than right in terms of estimating these things. But I don't know it. I hope that answered your question. I'm not, I know P2s, P1s, P3s, all these different kinds of centrifuges. I'm not an expert on all of them, but I think the only other point is what I've heard is that the North Korean centrifuges have a lot fewer problems than the Iranian ones, and that they've kind of tinkered with them in ways that make it easier to operate.
Anyone else?
And so that put everyone to sleep.
One more, thank you.
Thank you for being
That's
gracious.
Okay.
Just on your last remark that you think we underestimate what the North Koreans can do with the nuclear program, I've talked to a number of rocket experts who are very cautious about attributing capabilities to specifically the KN-08 and the Musudan because we haven't seen evidence of their testing, of their being launched yet. And then I've heard from other people saying, well, we still shouldn't underestimate them. Maybe they do have an operational ICBM, even though it's never been tested, and even though the Soviets and the U.S. never had an operational ICBM without extensive testing. What's your thinking on this?
Yeah, that's an area where I think there's, at least in my mind, some certainty. I don't think they have an operational ICBM. I mean, there are a number of different kinds of tests you have to. And I don't mean just firing it off, but you need a reentry vehicle for an operational ICBM. You need to do a certain amount of testing for that. As far as we know, they've done none of that. So I think that's a bridge too far. Whether they have missiles to reach targets in the region, I think is a bridge that's less far away. And on top of that, we shouldn't assume that just because we tested the hell out of everything, that the North Koreans are going to pursue the same philosophy. The Chinese didn't pursue that philosophy. The Chinese did much fewer tests of everything. So, I think the North Koreans are more likely to pursue sort of a Chinese approach than an American or a Soviet approach to those systems. But there's a limit, there's a limit to the credibility. So I think that a limited approach might give them some credibility, but we need to see at least some tests of the longer range systems. Not hundreds of them, but at least some.
All right, I take it back. One more for Sam. Okay. Very last question.
Sam Brown, I'm here on a matchup basis at Security Project. Hello. Can you really differentiate a little bit more clearly what your difference is with the administration's policy of patient, strategic patience. It seems like you also are somewhat patient.
I'm strategically cautious.
Or diplomatic patience.
Diplomatic patience.
But you also seem to be willing to acquiesce over the long run, but you're not saying so explicitly, in North Korea being a nuclear power. You want to de-emphasize our preoccupation with that and engage in diplomacy with respect to the larger compass of political issues. So I don't see that there's that much difference between your position and the administration's position, in fact.
Well, I think there is a big difference between the two of us, but I see what you're saying. The first big difference is I don't want to just sit back and wait like they're doing now. The administration is not doing anything in terms of trying to start diplomacy with the North Koreans. That's the first part. They think that somehow, you know, we'll get the Chinese on board, we'll all put pressure on the North Koreans will cave in, give us what we want. They want to avoid talking. I don't want to avoid talking. I think the only way you're going to move forward is to talk to them, basically. We may not move forward, not saying it's guaranteed, but the only way we're going to figure out whether we can or not is to sit down. That's the first thing. There's more. You want me to stop?
A little bit more.
A little bit more? You told me I had till 2 o'clock.
You changed our mind.
That's the first point. The second point is what I want to do is structure a negotiating process that has the best chance of achieving denuclearization. What's the best process to get to denuclearization? The best process is to A, include measures that actually stop the nuclear program from growing, which it's going to do if the HEU program comes online. Stop it from growing, stop it from becoming more sophisticated, roll it back, and eventually hopefully get to denuclearization. But you can't do that in isolation. We're not just going to reach agreements that have denuclearization in them. You have to have other things in the agreement. And the other thing that's going to have to be in there is dealing with core issues of peace and security, a peace treaty on the Korean Peninsula. There's no way around that. So you're going to have to combine those two different things in phases and then also put in other measures. That's the best way of getting there. I'm not saying we're going to get there, but it's the best and only way of getting there. We're not going to get there through the approach with. I don't know if that is, but we can talk later whether that's convincing or not. But yes, as you're moving down that road, you're dealing with a North Korea that has nuclear weapons. I don't see any way around that. They're not going to wake up one morning and give it all up. You know, it's not going to be one day they say, yeah, we're going to denuclearize, the next day the nuclear weapons are gone. There's going to have to be a process. Going to have to be stages.
Joel, thank you so much. It's been a long time since I enjoyed a vote-in display like this, and I think you did break some news today. I hope everyone paid attention and will report on it. Thank you so much. The American Security Project. Thank you.